when you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side.
In his new memoir, Art Garfunkel writes, I have these vocal cords too. They vibrated with the love of sound since I was 5 and began to sing with the sense of God's gift running through me. It was that unmistakable voice as one half of Simon and Garfunkel that led to such hits as Bridge Over Troubled Water, The Sound of Silence, Mrs. Robinson, Homeward Bound, America. They were among the best-selling performers of the 1960s, becoming counterculture icons while winning 10 Grammys and being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. As a solo artist, Mr. Garfunkel has released over 15 albums and continues to tour. His new book, What Is It All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man, is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Art Garfunkel to our show. Welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
An underground man, do you see yourself as Dostoevskian?
I do. I have another reality running through life that's the subtext of everything.
And, well, the underground man, of course, was a grumbler. He was an unhappy person.
Well, I wouldn't summarize myself in such a short phrase. I think we're all everything.
This is a memoir.
We're all everything.
This is a memoir of sorts, but not a traditional one, from its type font to the anecdotes, the poetry, the lists, the photos. The book is more like an intimate look into someone's journal. Did you know from the start that that's the way you wanted to do it?
No.
How did you wind up with this type font? It was created specifically for this book?
No, I have been. I love penmanship. I have been doing these lists ever since I copied Martin Block's Make-Believe Ballroom and put down the top 30 every Saturday morning. I enjoy penmanship with my left hand, and I make it neat. It's kind of like how I sing. Syllable for syllable is the same as letter by letter in printing. So as I began to write, I began to form it in a, it was my idea, I'll make it look like a Penguin novel. And I got my novels and I took the dimensions of the margin, the size of the print, and I just tried to copy for the fun of it.
You came of age at the beginning of the rock and roll era. But you mentioned Martin Block. They were kind of like the kids' pop tastes were divided at that time. You either liked doo-wop and soul music in general, or singers like Frankie Lane and Patti Page. Martin Block was more the Patti Page style.
Yes, this is 1953, I would think. So there was a transition going on in America. We were saying goodbye to Perry Como and hello to The Rivoliers, I Love You for Sentimental Reasons. All this black music and New Orleans, Chicago, St. Louis stuff was coming to New York via Alan Freed. And that's what turned me around.
He came from Cleveland to New York.
Yeah.
And started banging on his, as I understand, a telephone book on the backbeat, and changed even the way the beat was played, because he brought it from 1/3 and 3/2 to 4.
You mean the backbeat is Alan Freed's?
Yeah, he was banging on it, kept his mic open.
Yes, I know.
Well, you say that you, well, first of all, you started singing when you were just 5?
Yes, at 5 years old, I realized I had a pleasing sound in my vocal cords. And the next thing I realized is it gets more pleasing if you're in a room with reverb, a tiled hallway or the bathroom or stairwell. And so that those extensions of the sound, that echo, was extremely pleasing to me.
Were your parents musical?
In an amateur way. Dad played the piano, and I watched his left hand fake it when he went down to the bottom. He wasn't a serious musician, but he and my mom could sing good enough and in tune to make Bye Bye Blackbird sound pretty good in the living room.
You write that as a kid, you went for the songs that had the goosebumps and the singers I just knew could sing. What were some of the songs and the singers that you're referring to here?
When Johnny Mathis gave us "It's Not For Me to Say," and I heard that vibrato, "Say," the finishing of those notes was magnificent. Who is this Johnny Mathis, I thought. So there's a killer singer. Joe Stafford, "Fly the Ocean in a Silver Plane." She was wonderful. Sam Cooke, "You Send Me," that open-throated, strong sound, but just poured on. It was full of delivery. I love Sam Cooke.
He came from gospel music. He was a quartet singer. Were you listening to gospel music as well?
No, that was the New Jersey Channel. That was the other end of the radio.
WNJR.
Yeah. Who was the disc jockey then?
Well, there were a whole bunch of people.
Was there one main evening man?
Yes. Jonathan Joe Crane was there. Well, there were a bunch of people.
No, I didn't listen.
In fact, Wolfman Jack started on WNJR.
Yeah.
But there were a number of other stations, LIB and WWRL, all playing the doo-wop records, and then they would switch to gospel.
But Alan Freed gave us a sense of all that stuff.
You met Paul Simon when you were both just kids. Do you remember the first time you spoke?
I don't remember the specific first time, but we were sixth graders in Queens, PS 164. We were graduating from grade school to go on to junior high. So we must have been 11. And the school had our teacher had a Alice in Wonderland graduation play, and they cast Paul as the White Rabbit, and I was the Cheshire Cat, of course.
Did you sing a duet?
No, there was no singing in the show. But backstage, he would crack me up. Paul has a great sense of humor and has had this all his life.
What were the circumstances of the first time you sang together?
Junior high school talent show, maybe? When did, you know, we were both rock and roll fans. That was a whole new phrase, rock and roll.
Alan Freed gave us.
Yeah, and I remember the night. I remember when he said, "We're going to call this rock and roll now."
Although it had been part of, forgive me for being pedantic
here. Tell me,
no,
you're about
here.
To teach me something.
It was part of the gospel scene as well. They'd say, "I'm going to rock for Jesus and roll for the Lord."
Ah, so it's not only sexual, it's that. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul and I started using our voices and blending, and we saw we had good pitch. We started singing into my wire recorder. Dad had a wire recorder. We recorded. And then we realized we can put sound on sound, which is what studio people know. You build up layers of sound. We call them overdubs. And when Paul and I realized the fun of that, you put down our vocals in harmony, and then you put more Paul and Artie's on top of that. That was great fun. We must have been seventh graders.
My guest is Art Garfunkel, in case you didn't guess. He has written a memoir called "What Is It All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man." And you and Paul were only 16 the first time you sang on American Bandstand. You performed as Tom and Jerry.
That's Leonard. That's right. Why are you so disdainful?
I'm not. I just it's amusing that you Tom and Jerry sounds a lot more typical of the time. But I've always wondered whether you would have made it as big if you hadn't changed it to Simon and Garfunkel.
Well, didn't we go downward when we made it Simon and Garfunkel? We always thought that was the absence of finding a real name. Mm-hmm. It was by default we were Simon and Garfunkel. So I think it's just gotten, the ear has gotten used to that as a name of a good group.
Was Hey School Girl the Tom and Jerry?
That was the Tom and Jerry hit, mm-hmm. Hey School Girl. In the second row, the teacher's looking over, so I gotta whisper way down low. Dig this, Leonard. To say woo bapalucha ba, that's me. Woo bapalucha ba, which we stole from Bebopalula, Gene Vincent's hit.
Mm-hmm. He's my baby. She's my baby. So you were you writing these songs together?
At that point, we were, yes.
So what were you and Paul thinking after you graduated from high school? Did you have plans of playing and singing together as a career?
No, we split up. When high school was over, I went off to Columbia College, a tough school. You really had to make friends with books. Paul went to Queens College, and he stayed in the old neighborhood. I went to Manhattan, and we charted different paths.
And you have a master's in mathematics, don't you?
Mathematical, the teaching of math, yeah.
So did you think that's what you were going to end up doing?
No, not really. I was laying low instead of going to Vietnam. Yeah. It was the early 60s. I was starting to have hit records, so the fun was out there across the country in the colleges and doing concerts. And I'd have to come back to New York to rejoin my classmates at the teacher's college so that I wouldn't go to Vietnam.
So you and Paul then broke up, what, two or three times?
What do we call a breakup?
Just moved on for a time?
We break up all the time. Every time we say goodnight,
but is it breaking up hard to do?
Yeah, it hurts the heart, but if you assume, somebody told me this, I like it. When you have a fight with somebody, but you know you're going to get over it, it's just acting out. The fight is just a play act. They're family. You know, you don't think with your brother you're going to permanently say goodbye to your brother. You know it's family stuff. You will resolve it in time so that the fight is acting out. I like that.
Mm-hmm. But if you add up all the time that you and Paul were together, it's maybe 5 or 6 years.
Something like that. We had our salad days in the second half of the 60s, and that was 5 years. And then we periodically got back together again. The word mirthful comes to mind. We laugh a lot. If you saw the true Paul and Artie, you'd be surprised. It's about jokes. It's about the mutual love of music. When is rock and roll really infectious? When is the groove really groovy? This is our union.
It did help that your voices really blended well together.
I taught him.
You taught Paul?
Well,
he played the guitar, so that must have helped him.
Well, there we were in my basement, and Paul's guitar supported the sound we were making, and I was trying to bring the two of us into a nice blend. We would sit and look very closely at each other's face to study how the diction works, and then we'd get closer and closer. And we were finicky perfectionists about getting I like the word tooled. A very finely tooled sound, the way a Rolls Royce is finely detailed.
Your last album, Bridge Over Troubled Water, was released in 1970. It was the best-selling album of that year. But then also it was the best-selling album of 1971 and 1972.
Was it?
Yeah, that's an amazing feat. You're surprised to hear that?
Well, how you come at statistics is how you is your point of view.
Well, you were
I'm
a math
not surprised.
Major.
I knew that Bridge Over Troubled Water was a monster. I knew it had lasting quality. I remember, particularly in England, it stayed at the top of the charts right from year to year. It was huge.
I'm speaking with Art Garfunkel, who has written a rather unconventional memoir. We'll talk about the lists and some of the other stuff after we take a little break. It's called What Is It All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man, published by Knopf. Stay with us for more.
What a dream I had, pressed in organdy, clothed in crinoline. Smoky burgundy, softer than the rain. I wandered empty.
We're back with Art Garfunkel, who's written a memoir called What Is It All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man, published by Knopf. When I've spoken to some musicians, especially jazz musicians, they often cringe when they hear their recordings. What they hear is all the things that they could have done, the missed opportunities.
The
what
eye
is like
goes
when you
to
hear
the irritant.
Does that happen with you when you listen to your recordings?
Yeah, whatever's not quite right jumps out and makes you want to fix it. You know, if you're a perfectionist, all you see is what's not quite there yet.
So did you fix it when you were doing live performances?
Well, live performances is here it is, this is it, whatever. There is a painter I heard who would go to his gallery opening with his paintbrush and his paints before the crowd comes and the gallery is open. He's still fixing the corner of his painting. We're never finished with it. You want it to be God's gift. And you're not up in scale to him or her. So you keep pushing it.
What was it like to have hit after hit? Did you feel kind of trapped in a way?
No, not in the least. I felt enormously lucky, tremendously energized to do the next thing.
And now, writing this book encourage you to continue writing?
I don't think of the future when it comes to literature. I think of the present. I love this book. It was 30 years in the making.
You've been writing it all along?
Yeah.
Because there are lots of lists in here. You've been keeping those lists all along?
I don't know if I've been... Maybe that was part of the pulling it all together that I did in the last year. I've been writing these little prose poems, reflections on the all and the everything. For years, I walk across countries, Leonard. I've walked the United States.
You do a lot of walking, you reveal here.
Yeah. I've walked Europe from Ireland to Istanbul. Mm. So you carry your iPod, and you bring your notebook, and you write down insights. A phrase comes to me, and I go, that's a good grabber. That's the first line of something, and I know the something. It's the theme I've been thinking of all my life. Let me take the first line, I say to myself, and combine it with that theme, and then I'm off and running. Now the next 9 hours fly by, and I'm fixing, polishing, erasing. That night, I'm throwing it out and starting again, and a few days later, there it is. So lists is the least of what I do. When I finally thought, I showed it to Dan Strone, a guy in the publishing business I know. He said, I think this is a book, and he shopped it around and got me a book contract. Well, he got a lot of interest from different publishers. I finally then pulled it together as a proper book in those last few months last year to give it shape, and then came some lists and various things.
And there are these quirky things that you've included. Could you give us an example or two?
Today I met with my publicist. He wants me to tweet and to meet my audience where it's at. You love your new record, don't you? You want them to know it exists. Couldn't I be a glifter first? Or better, a dripster. See the pen drip. Feel the self-image take a serious hit. Does nothing embarrass? If I'm to be a tweeter now, then cut a hole in the seat of my trousers. Give me a feathered tail. All is fashion. Shame for sale. Oh, techno-America, tattooed and gadgety. When do we call you a national twadgety?
Do you do a lot of tweeting?
No. No, I don't.
It could get you into trouble if you become president of the United States.
So I hear. No, I'm very much a misfit in the modern age. I do have a BlackBerry, but that's all. I never bought a cell phone.
A BlackBerry?
You mean that's old?
Yeah, I think that they're going out of business.
Well, I just got it a little while ago. I never bought a computer, Leonard. I never got a cell phone. I don't own a car. I love literature.
Love obviously, if you're calling yourself a Dostoevskian character, let's get back to The Split. I'm sorry to dwell on it, but people have always wondered why at the height of your popularity did Paul decided to walk away from it?
I don't know the answers to these questions, Leonard. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think life happens to us, and I don't know why.
You've gotten together off and on since that split, most notably for the concert in Central Park in 1981. What was the feeling at that time? Was it just meant to be a one-off?
Yes. We weren't rejoining as if this is our new status. We're a duo again. It was a one-off.
Because you had established separate careers at that point.
Yeah. I think Lauren was part of... Lauren came to us and pitched the whole idea, and I loved it. And, yeah, it was meant to be a one-off.
You're talking about Lauren Michaels?
Yeah.
Of Saturday Night Live fame.
Yeah.
You include an interesting anecdote in the book regarding something George Harrison said to you about your Paul and his Paul.
I used the Beatles and my encounter with the four different Beatles on different occasions as a transition thing in my book. So I start with George and how he came and whispered behind my ear at a club. It was noisy. In London years ago We had played, Paul and I had played Wembley. And George came to me. We hardly knew each other. Art, your Paul is to you exactly like my Paul is to me. Now that really got me. And I got to know Harrison rather well. Sweetheart of a man.
Died tragically at a very young age.
Tough.
What's the process of writing a song like? Does it come to you immediately? Those old questions, the cliche questions, the melody first.
Well, do you mean
the lyric first, the title?
Songwriting is Paul Simon's thing. I'm not the songwriter.
But you've recorded a number of solo albums.
I've used other people's songs, and I've done a little bit of writing. Some of them are mine. There's a song, Perfect Moment, that is my song. But I'm a writer of these prose poems, and this is me as a writer.
And you never thought of putting them to melody?
It's an interesting question. The truth is, when I have tried to take a phrase, a literary phrase, and brought it to the piano and played chords that I thought would get me teary and into, the song inspiration dries up. It's not a song. It's a prose poem, that phrase. They are very different things, I found.
Art Garfunkel is with me. His memoir, What Is It All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the early 70s, you appeared in a couple of movies directed by Mike Nichols. Did you initially meet him when you and Paul worked on the music for The Graduate?
Yes. It was in Hollywood. He came by. He wanted us to supply tunes and sing in The Graduate, and he commissioned. So there in L.A., we came to the sound stage, and there was The Graduate without its music yet in its final form. And we stared up at the screen. I don't know where I'm going with the story, Leonard. But yes,
it's going to end with Mrs. Robinson.
Well, you're right. And as we sat around and he was saying, what you got? And we really didn't have any fresh thing. He said, well, I've been living with your pre-recorded things and I have slotted it in to The Graduate in various places. And I think it works. So we're good as is, unless you give me just one song. When Dustin is racing down the California coast to break up the marriage of Elaine, because love is driving him, I want something rhythmic and nervous and impatient. And Paul wrote, I said to Mike, well, Paul's working on a song, Mrs. Roosevelt. And maybe that works. And Mike, of course, said, you have a song, Mrs. Roosevelt, and you didn't think how perfectly that would be Mrs. Robinson. So right in that soundstage, and here's to you, Mrs. Roosevelt, we changed it. We finished the chorus. We had no verse. So in the movie, you hear us singing, do, 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 do. A verse that's not yet written until the album came along. Was it in the Bookends album? So that came later. And there you go. The one song, Mrs. Robinson, went into Mike's movie. To me, the interesting thing is that Mike must have had his eye on me as an actor. He might have said, I think Garfunkel is a screen presence. I'm going to use him in my next movie, Carnal Knowledge.
And were you surprised when he cast you? Because you hadn't taken acting lessons, but you were really good in that film.
Thank you, Leonard.
Well, believe me, people would have noticed if you weren't.
Yeah.
So
he had confidence, and then I gained some confidence. He handed me the script. I laughed at Jules Pfeiffer's script. I got confidence right there. I'm not an actor, but when I read who I'm supposed to be on the page, I can do that.
So why weren't there a lot more roles? Because you were good in that. You were good in Catch-22.
The truth is, I'm a singer. First and foremost, I'm a singer. I never was interested in dropping that career to become a movie star. Paul Simon thinks so.
He thought that's what you wanted to do?
Yeah.
You write candidly about the long-term depression you went through following...
Oh, that doesn't sound like me. Did I go through a long-term
depression? Well, you were depressed when your girlfriend, Lori Bird,
She died,
herself.
And that brought me into I went very isolated. I didn't think I was so depressed then as much as I pulled back and went solo. I was in my apartment uptown, listening to Bach's B Minor Mass and reading War and Peace and becoming very artiste, but very private. Didn't feel depressed. It felt like a loner.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I guess that could be a form of depression, but...
But maybe not.
And then a few years ago, didn't you lose your voice for a time?
In 2010, I lost my voice. I don't exactly know why. It might be that I did a tour in the Far East for an arena tour where you had to put out a lot of sound if you're working with Paul and the band, and that loudness might have cost me. That hurt, and for 2011 and 12, I sort of lost my identity. If I'm not a singer, who am I? So I was committed to bringing it back.
And you've been singing on the show? You sound great, so...
I'll take the compliment.
a new album in the offing.
The voice is back. I'd say yes to a new album if the record business was healthier. But I don't know how to navigate this modern record business.
Because it's not like the old days where you signed with CBS Records and they just put out album after album.
Well, how do you promote it? We don't have disc jockeys breaking new singles like we used to. It's a different landscape, and I don't get it.
And the music is quite different when I think back to the kind of what songs sounded like when I grew up and what you hear today. I'm not going to say one's better than the other.
Why not?
But
why not? Jump in, Leonard. Go
well,
for
it.
Well,
it's a generational thing.
Does the world evolve or does our society degenerate?
Well, what do you think?
Degenerate. I think we're losing it. I don't think we're evolving. I think we're going down.
And do you think that that's reflected in the way music sounds today?
The absence of the good stuff, yeah.
Is it a matter of melody or something else?
That's a lot of it. You reach for that guess because you and I know that there's something real there. I don't hear many songs nowadays. Don't go changing, ba-boo, ba-boo, ba-da-ba-boo. That's a real song. Do you hear those now? I don't know.
No, I think it's a lot more about rhythm these days.
Well, a great groove is a many splendored thing, and I don't know if I hear grooves on the radio that make me get out of my chair and have to move.
You've been inspiring listeners to call in. One mentioned that her father, Sidney Kay, taught you for your bar mitzvah, and you sent him a handwritten note in 2009 thanking him. You'd been thinking back to your bar mitzvah?
Well, he was great. Sidney Kay was a wonderful singing teacher for me. It's not that I go back to the bar mitzvah. I go back to Sidney and how valuable it was, what he showed me.
It showed you about what? About projecting?
Diction, pronunciation, what's overdoing it, what's not. The amount of what you do as a singer, the right amount.
So I'm
You're perplexed.
No, I'm afraid to ask the question everybody wants me to ask.
Ask it.
Do you think you'll ever get together with Paul for
I will not answer that question. How dare you, Leonard?
Well, everybody asked me to ask you, and I thought you would figure out what I was leading to.
Do I think that Paul and I will get back together again?
Even for a one shot.
I don't think so. Huh.
Well, meanwhile, you have this wonderful book that you've just written, and my great thanks to you for coming by to talk about it. What Is It All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man, published by Knopf. Art Garfunkel, it's been a real pleasure.
I had a pleasure, too. Thanks, Leonard.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.